Good evening and welcome to City Visions. I'm your host, Ethan Elkind. Over 650,000 people have registered to vote over the last 6 months in California's presidential primary tomorrow. Will California voters turn out, particularly now that the Associated Press has just tonight declared that Hillary Clinton has the delegates to be the Democratic nominee for president? So what impact will that have on the presidential race going forward? And what effect will all these new voters have on state and local races and other measures on the ballot? Joining us in the studio tonight to talk about these issues is Jason McDaniel, Assistant Professor of Political Science at San Francisco State University. Professor McDaniel specializes in urban politics and voting behavior. Welcome, Jason.
Thank you.
And also joining us by phone is Mark DiCamillo. Mark is director of the Nonpartisan Field Poll, considered by many to be California's leading public opinion poll. In his more than 30-year career at field research, Mr. DiCamillo has directed hundreds of market and opinion research studies and is a recognized authority on opinion trends in California. Welcome, Mark.
Thank you very much.
And we invite you, our listeners, to join the conversation by dialing 415-841-4134. Again, that's 415-841-4134. Or you can email us at cityvisions@kalw.org. You can post a comment on our website, kalw.org, or follow us on Twitter at cityvisionskalw. Well, let's get into it. This is an exciting time to host the show because tomorrow we have this big election. And Mark DiCamillo, I wanted to start with you. We just had this news that Hillary Clinton has been declared by the Associated Press and some other media outlets as the Democratic nominee for president. Of course, the Bernie Sanders campaign is upset by this and would love to hear from you since you've been polling on this issue. What do you see as the potential impact of this on tomorrow? In other words, what is your prediction for what's going to happen tomorrow?
Well, prior to the news, we actually had come out with our own estimate that about 8 million Californians would vote in this election. That would be about a 45% turnout compared to 31% 4 years ago in the last presidential primary, which was kind of a sleeper in California. But I can't really say what the impact will be. My gut says that the Sanders voters are intending to send a message and that they'll probably turn out in the same numbers or roughly the same numbers as what we had expected.
And so we have the Secretary of State's office reporting that over 650,000 new people are registering just the last 6 months, as I just mentioned in the opener. So, Professor McDaniel, what do you see about these new voters? Who are they, and what's motivating them to register now in such big numbers?
It's actually interesting. I've actually seen some figures showing about 2.8 million or over 2 million new voters. And they are, from what I've seen, younger. There definitely seems to be a Bernie Sanders effect. They're mostly Democratic. There are some Latino new registrants, but it's, I think, mostly from what I've been seeing, or at least a large portion of them are younger and whiter, more male, but nonetheless a substantial wave, much bigger than the new registrations we've seen prior to other 2014, 2012, et cetera.
And so you're mostly seeing this then on the Democratic side in terms of the Bernie-Hillary race, not on so much on the Republican side.
So the data I've seen, it's both, but most of the increase is on the Democratic side.
And Mark DiCamillo, I'm interested in this surge in turnout. You know, we hear so much about Donald Trump's heated rhetoric around immigration, his comments recently about this federal judge in San Diego questioning his Hispanic heritage and whether or not he's suited to judge this case on Trump University. Are you seeing anything in the field poll in terms of a big surge of Latino registration and turnout against Donald Trump in particular on the Republican side?
Well, certainly the Latino vote is coalescing. No matter who the nominee, whether it be Clinton or Sanders, the Latino vote will come out heavily, I believe, against Trump. When we ask a question such as, do you have a favorable or unfavorable opinion of Donald Trump, only about 10% of Latinos answer that they have a favorable opinion. When we poll either Clinton or Sanders against Trump, he loses by either 19 points against Clinton or 29 points against Sanders. So, I mean, it's not going to be a very close general election, in my opinion, and Latinos are going to be a big part of that.
Mm-hmm. And in terms of the presidential race going forward, so, you know, California, of course, is just towards the end now of a long primary season. Do you see the impact, and this is for Professor McDaniel, do you see the impact of tomorrow potentially shaping what happens afterwards?
Well, I do think that one of the impacts could be that how the candidates respond. If Bernie Sanders, after tomorrow, starts to you know direct his attacks towards Trump, starts to support the nominee, wraps up his campaign, I think it can have a positive effect on his supporters, supporting Hillary in the general. If he continues, and there's been two messages on this. I think his campaign is a little bit split on this, but if he continues to be a little bit more forceful, if he does take this to the convention the way he's talked about, again, most likely the vast majority, 80%, 70-80% of his supporters will vote for Hillary in the general, but there could be on the lower side of that number if he, depending on how he acts.
What do you make of the Bernie Sanders campaign, their reaction to this, the superdelegates, the sort of news leaking out that Hillary now has enough superdelegates to be able to clinch the nomination?
Well, I suppose on one side, they're quite angry about it. But on the other hand, I think it plays into their narrative that they've been pushing, which is that somehow the superdelegates are illegitimate. Now, that's not, and winning an election with superdelegates is illegitimate, except that he's been arguing that the superdelegates should support him for the past, couple of weeks at least. I'm certain that Hillary Clinton's campaign's not happy that this news is broken tonight, right? They definitely would rather have had the winning with elected, pledged delegates after New Jersey, perhaps tomorrow night, or at least after California. So they're very probably not happy about this. Nonetheless, this will be a story that goes away eventually, but I do think it perhaps furthers the possibility that Bernie Sanders' campaign challenges the superdelegate system at the convention and maybe puts pressure on Hillary Clinton's team to consider, reforming that system at the convention.
And Mark DiCamillo, we talked about this big surge in registration. How much can we expect that these voters will actually turn out? I mean, that always seems to be the big question. So what do you make of that dynamic?
Well, if you look at the increase, it's the net increase actually is only about 750,000. And the reason for that is that while there may be a new 2 million getting onto the rolls in the past 4 or 5 months, there are a lot of voters that the county registrars are also purging from the rolls. And so what you have is this replacement effect. And generally speaking, I do believe that Bernie Sanders is responsible for a big chunk of those new voters, because it does seem to be heavily tilted toward the Democratic side. But what you have are new voters who probably haven't been part of the process nearly as much as the voters who've been purged, who have either moved out of the state, died, or, are just no longer at their residences. And what you have is these new voters are actually somewhat less likely to turn out regularly in elections. So I hope they turn out, or I mean, I would expect that they're going to turn out for this election since they're registering for this election. But as a group, they have somewhat lower propensity to vote than the older people that they're replacing.
Mm-hmm. And Mark DiCamillo, you mentioned earlier that Bernie seems to do better versus Trump than Hillary Clinton. And I wanted to follow up with you on that. Why do you think that's the case based on what you've seen in the polling?
Well, I think what's happened over the past 4 months, I mean, it wasn't always the case where this was as wide a spread as what we're seeing now. What I would interpret it as is Hillary has taken a major hit among Democratic voters from the Sanders campaign. Her image rating in our polls has gone down 10 percentage points over the last 3 or 4 months among Democrats. And that's hard to do. I mean, usually Democrats are pretty loyal to their own nominees or potential candidates. But Bernie Sanders has done a major number on Hillary Clinton in terms of giving some voters in California pause about supporting Hillary. On the other hand, there's been no decline at all in Democratic preferences or Democratic views about Sanders himself. So, he's kind of escaped unharmed through this whole campaign. Hillary, on the other hand, has taken it from the left and the right. So, that's, I think, what's responsible for the differential in support.
And Professor Jason McDaniel from San Francisco State University, same question for you. Why do you think that Bernie seems to be polling so much better than Hillary against Trump?
Well, you know, I think the main reason is, as Mark said, that you know, as Bernie really started to attack her, you know, a little bit more forcefully in certain ways, right? As it became clear that, you know, it was those two. I mean, it's been that way for a while, but her numbers have gone to that, and her supporters are the ones that are less attached not only to politics in general, as Mark was saying, but to the Democratic Party. In general, they're a little bit less attached. So they're more, I think, more likely or more susceptible to being to feeling less favorable towards a Democratic candidate, especially the way in which Bernie set up this sort of establishment versus his sort of quote unquote revolutionary kind of point of view. I would say this, though, it is true that as far as my research is shown, and I don't know if this has changed recently, but Hillary has not done one negative attack on Bernie Sanders. Both or Hillary's PACs have not done one negative attack in terms of commercials against Bernie, and she's been relatively non-negative even in debates and in appearances, and so I do think that's part of the differential we're seeing, where his numbers are pretty solidly stable where hers are going down. I mean, she's been, you know, the subject of attacks for several decades now, and I think we're seeing the result of that.
And Professor McDaniels, on this point, do you see that same dynamic playing here locally in the Bay Area? The voter sentiment is mirroring what you're just saying. Here.
I think, you know, from what I can tell, I think her supporters tend to be a little quieter, a little bit less vocal, right? Mm-hmm. Whereas a lot of people I talk to, whether they be students or neighbors or what have you, or professionals, there is the energy, that Bernie Sanders has really stoked that is directed against her and against an establishment in general. And there's the sense that I hear her talked about as being corrupt or what have you. That makes me I don't like to hear that kind of thing, because I try to have respect for, someone who's going to be the first, female nominee of a major party and who has been in politics serving with distinction for decades. But I do think there's a lot of that in San Francisco, and I would not be surprised. You know, Bernie Sanders will probably win San Francisco pretty strongly when it comes to tomorrow night in terms of the vote.
Mm-hmm. And Mark DiCamillo, you talked about trying to predict turnout tomorrow and how, the voter rolls are changing. I'm wondering if that might also apply to how we do polling. I mean, you're one of the most recognized pollsters here in California, and we hear a lot about now it's harder to reach people. In the old days, everyone had a landline, so if you call them, you're pretty much getting a representative kind of sample. How are you in the sort of process of polling engaging what's going to happen tomorrow? How are you taking into account all those changes?
Well, certainly we're doing a lot more calls with people on their cell phones. About two-thirds of all the interviews in our latest poll were with voters on their cell phone. That's, a pretty high proportion compared to the past. But I do agree that polling is undergoing a lot of changes, and I think you'll even see the field poll begin to experiment with alternative methods of trying to reach voters. So we may be able to reach voters by email. So, if there could be ways in which the field poll can improve its estimates, we're going to try to experiment with them as we move forward.
And Professor McDaniel, what are your thoughts about the state of polling today?
Well, I would add to that, Mark probably didn't want to say this, but if anybody's read Nate Silver's 538 pollster rankings, the field poll is the top-rated one, right? It gets an A-plus ranking, 100% correct. So if they're considering, working with some, online, some email, I doubt, this thing that I've been working with, this idea of non-probability sampling, which some of the accurate national pollsters are beginning to do, some of the new pollsters. It is a tough time to be a pollster, and I've just been stepping my toe in the waters of doing some of that at SF State. It is tough, and so I just, want to say to people, we should be thankful at field polls, how good they are, and how long they've been there doing it.
Well, and we're also thankful that Mark's here on the show tonight talking to us. So we've talked a bunch about Bernie versus Hillary in the Democratic side, but what about the Republican side? Donald Trump has been the effective nominee now for at least a month or so. How is that going to affect Republican turnout? Mark DiCamillo, has your polling outfit sort of looked at that question?
Yeah, it's actually one of the reasons why the turnout is only going to be about 45%. I mean, if the Republicans had a contested primary at the top of the ticket, we'd see turnout above 50%, or at least that would be my expectation. I don't think the Republicans will be turning out in force. I think it'll be a heavily tilted Democratic electorate. That could have impacts down the ballot. For example, the U.S. Senate race is an open primary. I think the heavy tilt toward the Democrats on the presidential vote will impact the U.S. Senate race and will increase the chances that two Democrats will emerge as the open primary general election candidates. So, you know, this is just not a great year in California to be a Republican, given either the turnout impact that the Trump candidacy has or even the rhetoric that's coming out of the Republican Party. It doesn't play well in California.
Well, you could almost start to say that every year now about being a Republican, at least at the statewide level in California, the way the demographics and the polling have gone there. And I do want to talk about how this potential depressing effect on Republican turnout, given that settled race, may have on the state and local races. So we're going to get to that. But one thing I wanted to bring up on the Republican side is it's been interesting to me to see a lot more mainstream media attention given to the idea of a third-party candidate, and in particular the Libertarian Party. I saw that Gary Johnson is two-term governor from New Mexico, has on his ticket William Weld, former Republican governor from Massachusetts, and Governor Johnson was on Meet the Press over the weekends, getting some major media play. Mark DiCamillo, are you polling, taking into account potential third parties and how that might affect certainly the Republican race, but the race in general for president?
Sure. As we turn our attention to the general election, our next poll will likely be coming out right before the Democratic convention, but we will include Johnson as a third-party candidate, along with kind of side-by-side a two-person race to see what effect it has, because really what you want to see, not only what is the early support level for Johnson, but also from which candidate is he drawing more of the support? Is he getting more of the support from those who might otherwise vote for Trump, or is he getting more support from those who might otherwise be voting for the Democrats? So it's going to be an interesting exercise in polling. It's certainly something we're going to do in our next poll.
And Mark DiCamillo, do you have any indications at this point where you think he's going to be drawing from, Gary Johnson or any other, you know, third-party candidate like that, but particularly Libertarian candidate?
The threshold that he's going to have to achieve, and I'm sure he's not there now because not many people know who Johnson is nationwide or even in California, but he's going to have to try to get to at least a 15% threshold, because usually that's the threshold that the national media use when inviting candidates to participate in debates, presidential debates. So that would be the challenge and the threshold that he'll need to get to by the time we get past the conventions. And, you know, there's certainly enough time for him to become better known before then if there is this hunger and need for another candidate.
Well, I think driven by the historic unpopularity of both candidates, I think you're partly why you might be seeing this attention. But Professor McDaniel, I want to ask you the same question about, you know, this Libertarian third-party candidate. If you see there's some traction there, and which party that might detract from when it comes to the general election?
I think that the support for the Libertarian candidate will basically go draw from Trump, because this will, you know, some Libertarian candidates will draw from both parties. But as the more educated male, maybe the tech worker, that maybe lean Republican, I suspect they'll go more with Clinton this time around, because that demographic is becoming more Clinton and will not go towards the Libertarian candidate this time around. That being said, I wonder if, just in California at least, whether Jill Stein of the Green Party will, certainly not be reaching 15%, but if she's reaching 5%, in a poll, pulling, from Bernie Sanders supporters, probably that's not going to change much, but it might make it so that the field poll might at least have to consider the possibility of polling Jill Stein and Gary Johnson.
And Mark DiCamillo, just to confirm, are you polling for Jill Stein and the Green Party as well?
We hadn't yet planned to do so. We're basically a media poll, so we're following the news media, and we're great intakers of news reports. So the extent to which she gets more play, there'll definitely be consideration for putting her on a future poll. But right now, the attention seems to be towards Johnson and, his candidate, his VP candidate, Weld, which, are both established politicians. They've served as former governors of two states. So that's what kind of motivated us to decide to put him on our next poll, but we're open to any news that allows us to change our opinions on what we should be doing next.
All right. Well, this is City Visions on Local Public Radio 91.7 KALW San Francisco and on the web at KALW.org. Tonight, we're talking about California's presidential primary with two experts on voting behavior, Mark DiCamillo, director of the nonpartisan field poll, and San Francisco State University professor Jason McDaniel. We invite you to call in with your questions or comments about tomorrow's presidential primary and California voters. So please bring us your questions or comments. A number to call to join the conversation is 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. You can also email us at cityvisions@kalw.org, post a comment on kalw.org, or follow us on Twitter at cityvisionskalw. Well, we talked just about how the Republican turnout is likely to be low, and meanwhile, the Democratic turnout is probably going to be surging to some extent. We'll find out tomorrow. And this is going to have an impact on other races, so it's not all about the presidential primary. We also have, for example, a U.S. Senate race where we have Attorney General Kamala Harris, who seems to be in the lead on that. And Mark DiCamillo from the field poll, what are you seeing on the U.S. Senate race? It seems like it's a very big field, but Kamala Harris seems to have a sort of early lead in that respect.
Oh, there's no question. I would go way out on a limb and say Kamala Harris will be the top vote getter in tomorrow's U.S. Senate race. All polls seem to indicate that. She's got a big lead over the second place finisher. The question in the U.S. Senate race is who will come in second, who will be her opponent come November. That person can be from any party because it's now an open primary. What our poll suggests is that Loretta Sanchez, another Democrat, will likely be the opponent, which would be a historic kind of event in California. We've never had for a U.S. Senate or any other major statewide office two candidates from the same party squaring off against one another. I think that's likely to happen this cycle.
And Professor McDaniel, what are you seeing locally here about the U.S. Senate race with Kamala Harris and Loretta Sanchez and the others?
You know, I haven't seen even very much energy at all, actually. I think it's pretty much assumed by everyone around here that Kamala Harris will win, and it'll be pretty easy, right? Most of my students, you know, they're focused on even smaller local races, if anything. You know, I think it is amazing testament to how much the Republican Party's declined, but also how many that they couldn't, you know, clear the field for a couple of Republican, you know, candidates. You know, it's to have two Democrats face off in an open, you know, U.S. Senate seat is an amazing testament to what's happened to the Republican Party here.
Yeah, well, Professor McDaniel, staying with you on this, why do you think the Republican Party wasn't able to find someone who could really sort of galvanize that side of the field?
You know, politicians are what we call strategic. They want to run when they can win. And it looked to me like none of them thought they could beat Kamala Harris. And so they didn't want to risk themselves in a losing battle. I mean, that being said, I'm still surprised that you didn't need any, you know, second-tier candidates coming in, like the mayor from San Diego, perhaps, that can establish themselves statewide, at least as the, you know, sort of leader of the Republican Party right now. There's not even really a leader of the Republican Party, unless maybe it's, you know, Ron Unz or something statewide. And that's really amazing for someone who's, you know, lived most of my life in California. And to see this, it's quite amazing to see how that's changed in the Republican Party.
Yeah, and I suppose another candidate on the Republican side, the mayor, Ashley Swearingen from Fresno, who finished relatively well given in her losing race for treasurer, I believe it was.
Exactly. And again, surprising that wouldn't try to take on one of the Democratic candidates. Again, if there's just a couple, if there was one major Republican candidate, they probably would have, you know, gotten to the top two. But another interesting way in which the top two is producing some unintended results.
Mm-hmm. And Mark DiCamillo, on this Senate race, if it does come down to two Democrats in the fall, given what you're seeing in the polling, do you think if it's a Kamala Harris versus Loretta Sanchez, a Democrat versus Democrat, you know, potentially you've got some ethnic politics at play if Sanchez is able to draw more heavily from the Latino demographic? What are you seeing in terms of how that race may shape up in November?
Yeah, we actually posed that hypothetical to voters in our last survey, and Harris would start the campaign with a 14-point lead over Sanchez. What's interesting is that Republicans, given a choice between two Democrats, many of them say they wouldn't vote, which, you know, may or may not be true. I mean, I would expect most of those Republicans to be casting a ballot in the presidential campaign come November. Plus, there'll be a lot of statewide ballot propositions. What they may be saying is they'll leave the U.S. Senate race blank. But I don't know. It presents an opportunity for Sanchez or even Harris to try to broaden their support to these voters who just don't like either alternative. But I think that's what's unique and interesting about the Senate race with two Democrats is the effect that it's going to have on the Republican Party voters.
And Professor McDaniel, what do you foresee in November if we get down to a Sanchez versus Kamala Harris race?
Well, for me, I think it comes back to a time when a lot of the divisions in California were geographic. And, you know, you're going to see this be a Southern California versus Northern California thing. And it used to be the case that the Northern California voters were high-propensity voters, whereas a lot of the voters, especially Latino voters in Southern California, were low-propensity voters. And that's still relatively the case. But I don't think Northern California candidates can, you know, rest on their laurels very, very easily. I think Kamala Harris will win this race easily. I think in the next 5 years of California politics, the divisions are going to be between, you know, Southern California, Northern California, more so than they have been in the last couple of years, and it's going to be between Democrats, and that's interesting. As someone who's from Southern California but now resides in Northern California, I think it's interesting.
And we're focusing so much on the horse race, but I just have to ask, with sort of a substantive question here, if it is a Democrat versus Democrat Senate race, which I imagine is one of the few times in our history we've had a situation like that, certainly here in California, what do you think might be the issues that the candidates would seize upon to distinguish themselves?
That's a great question. I think you're going to see a lot of it trying to maybe build on some of the it depends on who they're reaching out to, but I think you're going to see people reaching out perhaps to kind of a Black Lives Matter movement, kind of thinking about race and racial dynamics and making government work for everyone. I think inequality will be some of the issues that I think Kamala Harris will want to talk about, whereas I think Loretta Sanchez might talk about her experience in Washington, D.C. and being that kind of stable leader, maybe there's going to be plenty of room for her to reach out to Republicans, and maybe there'll be a temptation on her part to run and kind of what we might think of as a blue dog Democratic kind of race, which is not, I don't think, naturally her where she comes from on a lot of issues, but I think there will be a lot of temptation for her to do that.
And Mark DiCamillo, do you have any polling about what the sort of issues might be that resonate with the segment of the electorate that's either for Kamala Harris or for Loretta Sanchez or any of the other candidates?
Well, we've done some polling on the issues that are important to Republican and Democratic voters this year, and they're quite different, and the priorities are very different. So the question would be, would somebody like Sanchez try to broaden her support by trying to appeal to the Republican side of the aisle? If that were the case, the issues that would be most attractive would be to play up things like the terrorist threat or protecting the homeland. That's a major issue, much more so to Republican voters than Democratic voters. Reducing the size of government is also a big Republican issue. Very few Democrats take that as a major issue. So, obviously the economy and jobs are going to be important to everybody, or most voters from both sides, but it really is a kind of a strategic decision on Sanchez's part if she does become the second place finisher tomorrow as to how she wants to proceed forward. I mean, she does have the support of Latinos in our poll, so that would be something that she could play off of. But beyond that, how do you broaden support against the mainstream Democrat like Kamala Harris? It's going to be an interesting exercise.
Especially if, Democrats are no longer as divided as they used to be, 20 years ago, 30 years ago. So it's not very natural for two Democrats to go one to the right and one to the left. So I do think it'll be difficult for her. And I think her ties with the Democratic Party, although she's, retiring from Congress, from her seat there, she would be risking a lot of that. So I think it will be a difficult choice for her to make.
So this is City Visions on local public radio, 91.7 KALW San Francisco, and on the web at KALW.org. Tonight we're talking about California's presidential primary as well as local and state races with two experts on voting behavior. So we have Mark DiCamillo on the phone line. He's a director of the Nonpartisan Field Poll. And we also have Professor Jason McDaniel from San Francisco State University. We definitely want you to call in with questions or comments about the election tomorrow and on prospect for turnout. So please do call in. The number to join the conversation is 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. You can also email us at cityvisions@kalw.org. Post a comment on kalw.org and feel free to follow us on Twitter at cityvisionskalw. Well, we've talked U.S. Senate race. How about a different kind of Senate race? We have a state Senate race that's happening in San Francisco for Mark Leno's seat. And this is a race between Jane Kim and Scott Wiener. This race, I think, got a lot more attention recently when Bernie Sanders endorsed Jane Kim. Meanwhile, the State Democratic Party and the San Francisco Chronicle have endorsed Scott Wiener. So let me start with you, Professor McDaniel. What do you think is going to be happening tomorrow in this race?
Well, it's been interesting to see that, you know, a lot of the energy has been with Jane Kim. She's been campaigning hard. You know, a lot of I'm getting a lot of mail, a lot of door hangings, door cards from her. I've been seeing her at a lot of events, seeing her at a lot of events lately with Bernie Sanders. And the conventional wisdom is, and the polling that I've seen, and the polling is a little old, but the polling I've seen shows that Scott Wiener is comfortably ahead. But like we're going to see, apparently in the U.S. Senate race, we're going to see this, you know, go a second time around in November. And I think what Jane Kim's goal has been is to make it either very close or maybe a surprise win to really shake up the conventional wisdom going forward to November. And I think she's got a chance of doing that. The Bernie Sanders endorsement really has, from the people I've talked to, shaken up the dynamics of the race. I still expect Scott Wiener will win, but it'll be much closer than we would have expected before that.
And Mark DiCamillo, have you been polling this the state Senate race? Any insights on the Jane Kim versus Scott Wiener state Senate race?
No, unfortunately, we're a statewide poll, the field poll, so I'll defer to my colleague from San Francisco State on his knowledge and judgment in that race. I really haven't been following. I don't really have a lot of information to share on that race.
Well, we'll definitely get back to you with more statewide issues, and let's go to the phone lines now where we have Jackie. Jackie, welcome to City Visions.
Thank you. Could you clarify what we're supposed to do at the polls tomorrow if we are registered no party preference?
So
either as a mail-in voter or a someone who shows up at the polls.
So yes, we have a Republican primary, we have a Democratic primary. If you're not a Democrat or a Republican, Mark DiCamillo, what do you say to people who have a no party preference?
Well, certainly, if you've already received your ballot by mail, maybe you're a permanent mail ballot registrant, which automatically sends you a ballot in the mail. If no party preference voters, they need to do one additional step, and if they haven't done it by now, what you would need to do if you're a mail ballot voter is to bring that mail ballot to the precincts to request a Democratic primary ballot if they're intending to vote for Bernie Sanders. The other half of the equation are no party preference voters who just are precinct voters, and if they're just planning to show up at the polls, they should, and they want to vote in the presidential primary in the Democratic side, they should request a Democratic ballot when they show up at the polls. If they don't make that request, they'll just be given a neutral ballot which has no presidential ticket on it. So that's really the additional step. You have to request it if you're a no-party preference voter, either in person or by doing it through the mail, but it's too late to do it by mail now.
Great. Well, thank you, Mark DiCamillo, for that response. Hopefully that's helpful for all the people out there who don't have a party preference. Going back to this state Senate race with Jane Kim and Scott Wiener, Professor McDaniel from San Francisco State University, since this is another Democrat-on-Democrat type of primary here, what are the issues that distinguish these candidates if you're trying to decide between Kim and Wiener?
You know, I think a lot of them, it's been housing. It's land use. It's how much the process of housing is going to be continuing to be regulated by communities and governments, or how much of it is going to be, you know, more streamlined and the idea of building more. I think that's the major divide. We're seeing that divide in San Francisco in general, breaking down along those lines. In terms of racially and ethnically and demographically, it's a younger support for Jane Kim. Younger people that I've been talking to across the board are more likely to support someone like Jane Kim, Bernie Sanders. Sanders in addition to that, Scott Wiener. It's more of a technocratic. I mean, when you have two Democrats going, frankly, in Sacramento, they would be voting together the same way 90 or 95% of the time. So it often comes down to temperament, name recognition, and then racial and ethnic composition of their base. And Scott Wiener's base seems to be a little bit larger with the more coincident with the district. But Jane Kim is I think counting on and will receive a large portion of support from the Asian American community, which has been increasing its voter turnout every year that I've examined it in San Francisco. And so I think that will play a big role in this, and I think it will provide a big boost for her. But again, I do expect Scott Wiener to win. And again, I think he'll do that on the basis of not campaigning very much, but campaigning on the sense of he's known, you know me, you voted for me before. I'm someone who he thinks about transit in addition to big issue for him. I think homelessness on the other side of it will be a big issue. A lot of these issues that are going on in San Francisco right now.
And you mentioned the battle that may shape up on land use issues and housing, and there is actually a Measure C that we're going to talk about in a bit for the San Francisco voters on affordable housing. But I want to go back to another statewide issue. So we talked about all the different races, and there's also these voter initiatives that are on the battle. That actually, it's not voter initiatives for this round. I believe the voter initiatives come in November, and this is where the legislature, I believe, can put measures on the ballot. So one of these statewide measures is Prop 50. It's the only statewide measure on the ballot tomorrow. And if it passes, it will enable the legislature with a two-thirds vote to suspend legislators without pay. People are calling this the Leland Yee measure, in part because he, along with two other state senators, were facing some criminal investigations and were suspended. But because of this lack of this kind of a measure, they were still getting their pay. And so some people say it's the weirdest measure on the ballot. I have to admit, I voted absentee a few weeks ago, looked at it, and really had no idea why it was on there. And there must be some other motive behind it. But Mark DiCamillo, are you pulling on Prop 50, and what are you seeing so far on this?
Now, as you kind of allude to, it's a sleeper type of proposition. It's not one that's been considered salient by the news media. They haven't really given it a lot of coverage. You know, in ballot propositions, they really fall into two categories, the ones that just get a lot of attention. Maybe there's millions of dollars being spent on the yes or the no campaigns to try to either pass them or defeat them. This is certainly not one of those, and we haven't even seen a lot of free media attention attached to Prop 50. The only polling that I've seen is very old. I think it was about a month or so ago. It had the proposition comfortably ahead. It sounds good on its face, so without any organized and very visible opposition, I guess my instinct is that it'll likely pass, but it's below the radar screen. We have not been polling on it.
So, Mark DiCamillo, is this usually the case then, if there isn't a lot of attention around measures, that they usually tend to sort of get approved, or is there any sort of history we can draw on there to have a sense of what might happen on Prop 50?
Well, again, it'll just kind of go on the summary and the merits. People will be coming to it by almost cold, and so they'll read about the ballot summary. The ballot summary seems relatively tame enough. Then the next process for voters is, well, who's behind it? Who's putting the money up, or who are the supporters, and do I like those supporters or not? But again, on this particular initiative, it hasn't drawn a lot of organized opposition, and so in the absence of any negative campaign or any organized opposition, it'll probably, the wording of it seems fairly tame, and, it's almost a motherhood type issue. I expect it to pass.
And Professor McDaniel, can you answer some of those questions around what's the motivation behind this, and what's likely to happen with Prop 50?
I think the key is to think about California's long history of sort of distrust of politicians, right? California has a very robust direct democracy process, and going way back into the founding of our Constitution, tends to assume politicians are going to be corrupt. All of the politicians except the ones we like, I think we think are corrupt. And so in most propositions and initiatives, when in doubt, a lot of people would say no. This is the kind of thing where they're going to say, yeah, can't hurt to put more, restrictions on our politicians. And, I think from Steinberg and the legislators' point of view, they probably, if they don't know this, the one thing that disrupts a supermajority or a very strong majority in a state house is are corruption scandals. And so I think they want to get on top of this maybe a little later than they needed to, perhaps, but to really say, look, we're doing something about this. We did something about this. So I think it's that history of lack of trust in politicians that will clearly pass this one.
And when you say Steinberg, you're referring to the former state Senate President Pro Tem Daryl Steinberg, who's now running for mayor of Sacramento. So that's a topic for another show and maybe another program.
And maybe he's running on that right now, you know, as part of his campaign.
That's a great point. This is City Visions on local public radio, 91.7 KALW San Francisco, on the web at KALW.org. We're talking about the big election tomorrow for the presidential primary, as well as state and local measures and races. We've got Mark DiCamillo, director of the nonpartisan field poll, on the phone, as well as San Francisco State University professor Jason McDaniel. Please bring us your questions or comments on the race tomorrow. The number to call to join the conversation is 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. And if you're shy about calling, you can feel free to email us at cityvisions@kalw.org. You can post a comment on kalw.org, or you can follow us and tweet us on Twitter at cityvisionskalw. So we've got Charlie from San Francisco on the line. So Charlie, welcome to City Visions.
Hi, I'm a member of the League of Women Voters in San Francisco, and I was going to let you know that the League has been very actively boosting Prop 50 on the ballot this year. Obviously, it's a process reform that they support, and that's the League of Women Voters in California and also the local league. They've been very active.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you for that comment. So, you know,
have another question.
Sure, please.
There's been some divisions on the Board of Supervisors, and occasionally, or often actually, Ms. Kim will line up with them. I guess you'd call them the progressives versus the moderates. And Mr. Wiener has been identified with the moderates, and many of those moderates are viewed as being basically more having allegiance to the pro-development side of the city, the condo towers and a lot of the densification south of Market. And I'm wondering if that is a factor both in this primary and also in the general.
So a question for Professor McDaniel. I'd like to turn it to you. Are these sort of land use battles, you know, driving some of what's happening here? And I guess I should also, you know, take the opportunity to mention that San Francisco is going to be voting on Measure C, an affordable housing measure, to bump the amount of below-market units required in residential buildings from 12% to 25%, which developers, of course, say is going to really hurt any kind of market-rate-type housing. Others say that there's such a long pipeline of projects and that, you know, this is basically not going to have a not going to hurt the development in San Francisco. But Professor McDaniel, what's your take on the land use battles in California and how Supervisor Kim and Wiener's race is affected by that?
I think the caller summed it up perfectly. I mean, that's the divide that will drive this, right? And that's bringing a lot of energy to the, as he said, what we might call the progressive side of things, really seizing on this, you know, with the election of Peskin and the sort of closer than expected re-election of the mayor last year. There's been a lot of energy on this, and that perception that the city's changing, the perception that the city is going to be growing too much or there's too much building happening. Whereas on the other side, I think rather than seeing it about being supporting big towers and developers, it's more the idea of seeing it as investment, seeing it as resources that bring resources to the city that can perhaps help increase tax revenue for transit, perhaps for schools. I think that's part of where we see the divide on that. And so, I think the caller nailed it perfectly. And the Prop C is very much being put on the ballot to take advantage of this wave. The idea that people support more affordable housing, especially government-subsidized affordable housing, and believing then that Sacramento governmental regulation of it is kind of extracting from developers more below-market rents. I think that's the a lot of the animating energy on this issue, and again, why I expect that to pass pretty easily as well.
So, Charlie, thank you.
Supervisors made endorsements on that ballot measure C.
I haven't seen them specifically, but I do think it breaks down pretty clearly the way you expect. Jane Kim strongly support Campos, Marr, Peskin, all strongly in support of Prop C. On the other hand, you're seeing people not necessarily be strongly opposed to it, but they have doubts. They say that it hasn't been studied. There's been no economic feasibility study. This is a big change to the laws. This is going to harm. There's a lot of projects in the pipeline that have been approved under one set of rules. I think on the other side, it's more like this is, can really be a disruption that might have some many unintended consequences, and then really might reduce the number of housing, affordable housing units that get built. Those are the arguments that I've heard.
So thank you, Charlie, for that comment about Prop 50 and also the question on the San Francisco race. I want to go now on the phone lines to Renee in Oakland. Renee, welcome to City Visions.
Paul, thank you for doing this. I had a question about Prop 50, and I thought that there was no provision for the person being found innocent. And if you could just clarify that for me.
So, Mark DiCamillo, I don't know how familiar you are with the measure. Otherwise, I'm happy to take a stab at it based on my understanding. But
I would defer to you on that. Again, we haven't polled on it, so it's not that much on my radar screen.
So, yeah, it's a great question, Renee. My understanding is that there really isn't a provision around that, but I don't want to, I haven't looked at it other than to know that there's a number of Republican elected officials who are very concerned that this is going to be used as sort of political retribution. So even though there's a two-thirds hurdle there to suspend without pay, that there is some concern around that. But it's a great question.
I think it's the idea that the legislature will decide, right? And so if they have probable cause, they won't use that language. Then it's a suspension. Maybe there's – I don't know if there's any provision for them to recoup the money lost if they're proven, in a trial innocent. But I think they're saying this is not about guilt or innocence. It's more like we want to be able to control our members and have some sense of being able to discipline our members when we think it's necessary. And so, therefore, it's not about innocence necessarily.
So thank you, Renee, for that question. And I want to go now to Lee from San Francisco. So, Lee, welcome to City Visions.
Yeah, I had a question about getting time off the vote. I know it's too late now, but I was hoping you could educate everybody on that. And what to do if your bosses deny you that right. And also had a comment as well.
So, Professor McDaniel, if you want to weigh in on what people can do to have access to the voting booth.
I do think access to the voting booth is the number one issue that I'm interested in. And California has been doing a better job, if not leading the nation, not quite, but on getting people to have access to the vote. But the caller brings up a very important issue. A lot of employers they're not legally allowed to prevent it on your time. I don't think they have to provide time to do it, right? But polls will be open for quite a long time, starting at 7 a.m. tomorrow till I believe 8 p.m. And so I think those whose employers make it difficult for them, I think that I would hope that no employer would say absolutely not, and perhaps would speak to their workers beforehand, give them time to make provisions to either do mail-in ballots or to drop their ballot off. If you did get mailed a ballot, you can drop it off in the morning, in a precinct. You can do that kind of thing. You can do a provisional ballot. I hope that none of our listeners and nobody is really being forced to not be allowed to vote by their employers.
And let me also throw that question to Mark DiCamillo from the field poll. You do polling for a living, and what do you see as the potential impact if we move to a model where, let's say, Election Day was on a holiday or maybe even a weekend or something where we could have greater assurance that people would have access to the voting booth? What effects do you think that might have on the nature of our elections and outcomes in this country?
Well, I think California has actually already kind of created a system that is attempting anyways, and probably does so, of giving voters a longer window in which to vote. And what that is the growing popularity of mail ballot voting. What's interesting, if you look at the last 20 years in California, you're seeing this huge increase in the proportion of voters who are permanently on the mail ballot registry. That means that they will get mailed their voting ballot 3 weeks before the election, automatically, without having to request a mail ballot or anything, and then you have literally a 3-week period to decide who to vote for and mail it back or even take it back to the voting precinct. We're actually expecting over 60% of the votes cast in tomorrow's election to be cast by mail, and if I had to guess, I think that a majority of all votes in nearly every statewide election in the future will be cast by mail, and it just allows voters a greater opportunity to sit down with the ballot and make a considered opinion. That's not to say that we should do away with precinct voting. It's just becoming a vanishing species just because you have to show up at a certain time on a certain day. Things can intrude. Your employment could intrude. Your family circumstances could intrude. Traffic could intrude. So, you know, the way to, I would even recommend it to new voters to get on the permanent mail registry. It gives you many more options and make sure that you can cast a ballot over a three-week period.
Mm-hmm. And it looks like we have Ruth Ann from El Cerrito who has a comment to make about access to precincts. She's on line one. Ruth Ann, welcome.
Yeah, hi there. Yeah, I'm a person with a physical disability, and I got so frustrated with my polling place where I get a disabled insignia on it that is accessible, and then I've gone to it, and it's not. And I've sent letters to the county clerk just saying this precinct was not accessible, and I cited all the reasons and documented it all. And I got a letter back from him after that, that was several years ago, and he said, we've taken off the disability insignia. And then the next ballot I asked about, I just said, where is my precinct? And when I was speaking to the registrar's office, they said the Christ Lutheran Church, and I said, oh, the prior registrar told me he was going to take off that designation. Why are they designating precincts as wheelchair accessible when they are not?
So a great question, Professor McDaniel. You want to respond?
Well, you know, I can't say why they're doing it when they're not. I will say that I would probably put this in the context of the limited resources that the state often has to run the elections. And finding, you know, volunteers or, you know, getting people, you know, even though they get a low amount of pay, getting people to work precincts, it's becoming not only a vanishing thing for people to vote at precincts, it's even harder to find people to work at the precincts during the day. It's an unappreciated job. And so I know that the Secretary of State takes that stuff very seriously. As the caller says, you know, I imagine it can be very difficult to for them to, if a precinct is not accessible the way it should be. But generally, I would put this in the context of we don't have national elections. We have statewide elections. And in California, you know, we're probably better off than many states where this stuff is really not taken very well, very seriously, or their resources aren't there to make it a very accessible situation for everyone.
So thank you, Ruth Ann, for that important comment. I want to turn to another important measure that's here regionally in the San Francisco Bay Area that we haven't touched on yet. It's Measure AA, the shoreline tax, as it's called. This measure asks voters in the nine-county Bay Area region to approve a $12 per parcel levy to supply $25 million per year for 20 years for things like wetlands restoration, potentially deal with sea level rise, environmental damage, and the overall health of the Bay. So, Professor McDaniel, for you in particular, is this unusual for all nine counties in the Bay Area to be voting on a measure all together?
It's fairly unprecedented. As someone who's interested in urban and regional governance and issues, I'm watching this one with quite a lot of interest. The Bay Restoration Authority got the legal authority from the state, did work with all the counties around the Bay to get this on the ballot in all the counties, and to have the situation be where it does not require a supermajority of every county, but rather a supermajority of all votes cast in all the counties in total, that's a big deal. That's a big change, and it means that people who are in favor of this measure, who want to spend more money on restoration of the Bay, or in the future, you know, potential future issues like housing or transit that are regional issues. This is I know that people are really watching this with interest because it means that places like San Francisco, like, you know, Alameda County can have a huge impact if they are in favor of these things that can outweigh perhaps the votes of places, you know, like Contra Costa or Solano that may not be as in favor of some of these issues. And so I think it could be a real step forward for regional governance and can really be something that other issues and other kinds of groups might want to get involved with in the future.
And I noticed that Quentin Kopp, former San Francisco supervisor and then state senator, Taxpayers Association have come out against it as sort of regressive because it's per parcel. Others, you know, say we all have an equal stake in the health of the Bay and in the future of the Bay. But because it's a tax, as you mentioned, it's going to need two-thirds of the voters to approve it. So Mark DiCamillo, what are you seeing generally with these kind of two-thirds hurdles? I mean, when are measures like this able to have that success to get over that really high supermajority bar?
Right. It's a tough threshold to get. Two-thirds requires, almost little opposition. Usually opponents can raise doubts. I mean, it is easier to raise doubts about a proposition than it is to make the sale that you have to vote yes. But on the other hand, I would say that the issue of climate change and protection of the Bay, environmental issues, is much more salient to voters in the San Francisco Bay Area than in any other region in California. So if this kind of an initiative, even though it's a tax initiative, has a chance, I think it would have a chance here in the Bay Area. So I'm very interested to see what the outcome will be. I'm certain it'll get over 50%, but the big question will be, can it cross the two-thirds vote threshold? That will be the what we'll find out after Tuesday night.
And we've got one of those San Francisco voters on the line, David on line one. You wanted to comment on Measure AA?
Well, yeah, the Measure AA has developed a pretty broad amount of support. In fact, I think really unprecedented. I noticed that more than 2,000 individual and organization supporters in favor of this. Everybody from Governor Brown, who's not always in support of additional taxes, to local mayors and county supervisors. I think it's really because the Bay is something that's extra special to people who live in the Bay Area. It's really the heart of the region. It gives the Bay Area its name, and people love the Bay. They want to see it healthy. So it's such a tiny tax that I don't think it's really developed much opposition, except from groups that oppose all taxes, no matter how small, no matter the purpose.
Well, thank you, David, for that comment. We've only got a couple of minutes left, so I want to hear some closing thoughts about tomorrow and the election. So let me start with you, Mark DiCamillo. What do you think is the sort of big takeaway thing we should be looking for tomorrow, or any final closing thoughts?
Well, I think the size of the turnout will be the most interesting and pivotal aspect of tomorrow's election. The bigger the turnout, I suspect, the better the chances that Bernie Sanders will actually catch and actually defeat Hillary Clinton. If it's an average kind of turnout or a subdued turnout, I think Hillary Clinton's got more of the profile of regular voters, older voters, and she'll be the favorite. So for me, the size of the turnout will be something I'm very interested in following, and also the shape of the turnout. Will the younger new voters who are putting themselves on the voter rolls for the first time actually take the effort to get to the polls? That's it's a tall order. I think once you become a voter, though, you're much more likely to be a voter the second time. So I think it's a great development for our democracy.
Great. And then Professor Jason McDaniel, real quick, final
just
thought.
Playing off that point, it's going to also impact the lack of a Trump campaign is going to impact the Republicans. So there's not be fewer of those younger Republican voters who are going to develop the habit of voting and being voters for the next generation. It's going to further negatively impact the Republican Party.
That's great. Well, I hope all of you are prepared to go out and vote tomorrow and do your civic duty. This has been a fantastic conversation to cover everything from presidential politics on down to the local races here. So that's City Visions for this evening. My guests were Mark DiCamillo, director of the Field Poll, Jason McDaniel, assistant professor of political science at San Francisco State University. Thank you all for joining me this evening. For a link to this and other City Vision shows and to let us know what you thought about the program, please visit the City Visions page on KALW. .org. Our engineer this evening was David LaTulipe. Tonight's show was produced by Ann Harper, and we hope you join us next Monday for City Visions. This is Ethan Elkind. Thanks for listening. Good night, and have a great week and a special voting day tomorrow.